Hi there, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. Our podcast covers one big news story each weekday in just 15 minutes. From history-changing world news to cost of living concerns at home, expert guests and ABC journalists explain what matters most. We cover breaking news and the big challenges of our time. Follow the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.
From Gadigal country, I'm Brooke Young, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the Prime Minister has promised to stick by copyright protections under pressure from artificial intelligence companies. But can the laws really keep up?
The way in which this technology has developed is indeed like nothing the world has ever seen.
Attorney General Michelle Rowland joins the program. Also ahead, a controversial visit to the UK by One Nation leader Pauline Hanson, who's been meeting with far-right activist Tommy Robinson and other controversial figures.
She also will be looking to put herself forward as the leading far-right figure in Australia and therefore attract the support of the same kind of people that have already put their backing behind Robinson.
And midnight screenings have marked the opening of Hollywood epic The Odyssey.
My dad is coming home.
Bringing it all.
You'll find out why Melbourne is the only city in the Southern Hemisphere where you can see it in all its IMAX glory. All that coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team. This is The Breakfast Wrap. These days, it's pretty hard to consume the news without hearing something about artificial intelligence and its future here in Australia. So yesterday, the Prime Minister used a major speech on AI to warn large tech companies that they must pay to use the work of artists or journalists to train their models.
Australian writers, musicians, artists and journalists must retain ownership and control of their work. No company should use Australian books, music, art or news to build or train AI without the artist's control. And that includes the artist's control of the price and value of their work.
That's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese there. And so there's little doubt that the legalities and ethical dilemmas of AI are a complex web. So to explain what the government plans to do to harness it, Attorney General Michelle Rowland joined Radio National Breakfast. And she began by explaining how AI challenges current copyright laws and why new ones are needed.
Firstly, the sheer scale of what these AI ingestion models, large language models, and how they process that information. The key here is that this is content that has been created by others. It is covered, as you say, in Australia by our copyright regime. But the sheer scale and the way in which this technology has developed is indeed like nothing the world has ever seen. But to the second point, countries around the world are grappling with this. In the United States, there are literally hundreds of cases that are on foot at the moment about what constitutes fair use. In some countries, in the UK, for example, there was consideration of imposing text and data mining exceptions so that AI could be capable of using this work to train their models. So it is an issue that governments, regulators and the artistic community and creatives right around the world are grappling with. And I think the Prime Minister's conviction, in which he stated the key principles that will underpin our copyright regime, should not only demonstrate that we take very seriously the issue of culture and the ownership and control, but also that we want investment in this country and we want workable solutions in an AI age.
A basic tech and legal question: how does a writer or artist know that their work is being used to train AI models?
Well, often not, but in some cases, as has been exposed by The Atlantic, you can go to a database and see whether or not it's being used. So in some cases, it comes as a surprise to those artists. But again, this is one which is an area that's obviously rapidly developing. And a key here is how do we ensure that artists are properly recompensed for their work?
You've ruled out a total exemption from copyright for AI companies mining data to train their models. Are you open to considering some sort of a flat fee or minimum payment for data mining?
Well, look, we've ruled out a text and data mining exception full stop. We're not revisiting that decision. We're not going to settle for an outcome that trades away Australian rights holders' control and payment for their work.
There are also risks posed by the use of AI in a variety of contexts that intersect with your portfolio, including the ability to create realistic images and videos to spread disinformation or to harm individuals. Will you revisit plans to enact new laws to combat disinformation?
Well, we made it clear at the time when the Senate rejected those proposed provisions that we would not be revisiting them, and that hasn't changed. The harm, however, is still there, and that's the way in which we view disinformation. If I can give you practical examples for your listeners, one of the key areas where people, particularly vulnerable people, are being harmed is through scams. And these are old problems that are turbocharged by AI. Our opponents in the Senate rejected taking legislative action on this, but we continue to undertake our scams framework, really important initiatives in this area. But again, I think it just points to the fact that the harm lens is one that the Prime Minister is very focused on, and that includes harms when it comes to technology and particularly its impact on young people, the kind of harms that can arise from nudify apps, for example, and the use of AI to undertake child sexual abuse. All of these areas still remain huge risks and are turbocharged in an AI environment.
On another matter, you've announced today you'll create a new criminal offence targeting larger companies which fail to prevent modern slavery in their supply chains. Earlier this year, the US announced it was planning to impose a tariff on goods from Australia, alleging that this country had failed to take adequate action on prevention of slavery and forced labour. Are these two matters connected?
Well, firstly, your listeners may not be aware that we've actually had modern slavery legislation in place in terms of it being a reporting requirement for businesses since 2018. So this is the first time that this legislation has been opened up in the way it is. But the important thing about what we are announcing here is that big businesses, so these laws apply to businesses over $100 million, need to demonstrate that they have taken action to prevent modern slavery in their supply chains. But on the issue of tariffs, we have consistently made the case to the United States that any tariffs on Australian products are unjustified. They're inconsistent with our bilateral free trade agreement. And what we've announced today in terms of our modern slavery reforms, they follow extensive consultation. And I think that they will be widely welcomed by Australians who don't want their supply chains in which they are consumers to be tainted by modern slavery.
That's Attorney General Michelle Rowland speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. Well, let's stay with federal politics and turn to what's been a rather controversial visit to the United Kingdom by One Nation leader Pauline Hanson. She's calling it a two-week, quote, fact-finding mission. And she's been meeting with a number of divisive figures, from pop star turned right-wing advocate Holly Valance to former Conservative Prime Minister Liz Truss and the far-right anti-Islam activist Tommy Robinson. And if that last name rings a bell, it's because Tommy Robinson's appearance on Carl Stefanovic's podcast last month led to Channel 9 severing ties with the presenter. Barnaby Joyce is a former Nationals leader and current One Nation MP for New England. And he fronted Radio National Breakfast to explain what the benefit was of Senator Hanson meeting someone like Robinson.
I think one of the big things there is to understand the social dynamic that brought about Tommy Robinson. Now, I don't support so much of what Tommy Robinson does, but I think it's incredibly important that we understand the social dynamic and how that came about. Tommy Robinson only exists because of the fracturous nature of where England has arrived at. And to deny that is to deny the facts. The issue there, and I've just got back from England, which I paid for myself, just so your listeners know, I paid for it out of my own pocket, is there is a social change, a change in many areas towards a form of Islamisation of the communities, and this has brought real friction, real heat, and has brought about the rise of groups such as Tommy Robertson. And if we...
Is he a credible figure to be talking to about those issues? The issues are undeniably existing at the moment. Is he the bloke to talk to about them?
Well, would you interview him, Sarah?
Tommy Robinson?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd hold him to account if I
interviewed.
That's
fair enough. And so that's the issue. And this is a discussion I had with Carl. I just think he absolutely deserves to... I mean, I would expect you to interview him. I really would, because I'd really want to know what is going on. I think, in fact, I think you have a duty to interview him. And I think that's what needs to be.
He's not an elected political official at the moment. Do you think that Carl Stefanovic...
But I think we all know that there is a massive following that he has, and we've got to understand that. And what we've got to do in Australia is make sure we don't replicate the social disharmony that has brought that about. And Sarah, we will if we go down the same path. Sorry, Sally.
You're right.
Sorry.
Is it an exercise in your view? Is it worth speaking to someone like Tommy Robinson? You're talking about the UK not going down the same path as the UK. Do we also not want to go down the same path as Tommy Robinson, a convicted criminal who's made some hateful comments about some communities in the UK?
I don't intend to replicate Tommy Robinson, but I am certainly want to clearly understand the social dynamics of...
I guess what I'm asking is, here is an example of how not to handle this rather than how to handle it.
I just like the question I posed to you. I know it was rhetorical. I think you, to learn more about an issue, you do talk to people. You work. I mean, I find everything about, I don't know, to take it to a ridiculous extreme, everything about Mussolini to be fairly repugnant. But if I had the opportunity to talk to him, I would, to work out exactly what was going on in their head.
If the idea is to talk to people to find out what's going on, has Pauline Hanson met with community leaders or Islamic leaders in the UK?
Well, I think you'll see there's a spotlight program coming out where she's doing precisely that.
She has spoken with Islamic leaders in the UK?
She's certainly talking to people in the Islamic community, but I don't want to give a plug to another stable, but I think we'll see that pretty soon.
In Carl Stefanovic's interview with Tommy Robinson, did he hold Tommy Robinson to account, in your view?
I think that, look, I was really sort of in support that the Fourth Estate, being also you, Sally, has a right to interview people. I think you have an obligation, actually, to interview people, and you have to interview. And people, me as a consumer of what you put forward, Sally, I'm discerning enough to make up my own opinions, you know, and I can listen to someone and read between the lines of whether this is a good person.
Can you make up your own opinion if issues regarding that individual, say Tommy Robinson, are not adequately raised, if he's not challenged?
I know about Tommy Robinson. You know about Tommy Robinson. Any person who's talking about AI, all you have to do is Google it and you'll soon find out all what you need to know. And then, look, I believe in the liberty of the individual in such a form as I can make my opinion about Tommy Robinson. And I form my opinion by the information I know. And if Radio National interviews him, which I would expect them to try and do, that assists me in making my opinion. And it also assists in the greater sort of ventilation of the issues that surround it. This idea of, we just don't talk to people anymore, and that's how we work ourselves in the public square.
Is it that, or is it failing to raise some of the tougher issues regarding that individual?
I first of all want, I know about the tougher issues. I mean, we're talking about it now. We know about it. But, you know, and I want to be able to hear the person and try and work out, for better or for worse, why did this person get the prominence and get the support they did? What went wrong that happened? Because if everything was completely cohesive and there was no problems, there'd be no Tommy Robinson.
That's Barnaby Joyce there, former Nationals leader and current One Nation MP for New England. Well, to unpack exactly who Tommy Robinson is and why this was such a controversial rendezvous with Pauline Hanson, Sally spoke to Daniel Trilling, an author and journalist who covers the rise of Britain's far right.
Tommy Robinson is a highly controversial figure in Britain. He's widely regarded as a far-right extremist who spreads disinformation and inflammatory rhetoric about migration and Islam and other issues. But he has got a relatively large following among members of the public. He's able to draw people out onto the streets to rally in support of his causes, and he has a huge following on social media.
How does Nigel Farage's Reform UK view him?
They keep a strategic distance from him. Reform UK's whole strategy is to present themselves as the acceptable face of the new right and to distance themselves from any hint of extremism or violence. And so a figure like Tommy Robinson is somebody that they say they don't want to be associated with.
Is there a sense in Britain that far-right activists like Tommy Robinson are becoming more mainstream or acceptable to the general public?
For somebody like Tommy Robinson, he's got a very loyal core of support. I would say opinion polls show that around 10 to 11% of the population agree with what he has to say, but there's maybe another 10 to 20% of people who are sympathetic to some of his claims and his narrative. And, you know, that's quite a new development in the UK for a figure that extreme to have that amount of support. His support is still a minority of the population. Where he is influential, though, I think, is in pulling the whole of UK political debate to the right.
What do we know about Tommy Robinson's criminal record?
He has a string of criminal convictions going back many years. Some of them are directly related to his political activity. So a couple of years ago, he spent quite a few months in prison for repeating lies about a teenage Syrian boy when he'd been ordered to stop doing that by a court. He has a restraining order against him for stalking and harassing a female journalist who was doing perfectly legitimate reporting on what he was doing with all the money that he'd received in donations from his supporters. He's also spent time in prison for mortgage fraud. So that's an offence not related to his political activity, obviously. But Robinson, for his supporters at least, has been able to turn all of these convictions into a kind of grievance narrative. He presents himself as the little guy who is battling against the establishment and that he's being persecuted simply for telling the truth, which ironically is a total lie.
What part of the major parties played in creating something of a political vacuum that has now been occupied by some of these far-right parties when people's grievances from the local, the county and the national level about standards of living and changes in their neighbourhood if people feel that they have not been adequately addressed?
I think the success of far-right politics in the UK, as elsewhere, is really an index of failures in the political mainstream. I think many people in Britain at the moment feel like the economy is not working for them and prospects for the future certainly don't look better and perhaps look worse. Politics itself does not deliver. You know, people feel that the traditional mainstream parties have either not provided enough of a choice between one another politically, or that they've constantly promised to do things politically that they then haven't followed through on. I mean, the UK has had 10 years of political paralysis mainly since the Brexit referendum, and that's led to a lot of frustration in the country. And then successive governments have mishandled the politics of immigration, where they've both failed to make the case for why Britain's economy requires immigration to grow and to succeed and to bring prosperity to the country, while at the same time pandering to anti-immigration rhetoric coming from the far right. And the situation that that's left us with is that mainstream politics has ended up displeasing pretty much everybody.
Daniel Trilling there, author and journalist covering the rise of Britain's far right. And you can hear that full interview with him and Sally Sara on ABC Listen under Radio National Breakfast. Well, it's the epic Greek poem that's been adapted to the big screen in epic Hollywood fashion.
You're pining me for a daddy. You didn't even know. Like some sniveling bastard.
Who's looking after your wife and son?
Do you see?
My dad is coming home.
Bringing vengeance.
Bringing it all.
Well, that's just some of the trailer for the action-packed film The Odyssey, which opened with midnight screenings overnight. Now, there's no denying that the Hollywood cast, featuring the likes of Matt Damon, Anne Hathaway, Tom Holland and Zendaya, is pretty top tier. But it's the actual film used to shoot the production that has movie buffs really buzzing. Christopher Nolan's adaptation of Homer's epic is the first to be shot entirely using 70mm film on IMAX cameras. And that means that there's only one screen in the Southern Hemisphere that's able to show the film exactly how the director wants it to be seen. And that's the IMAX cinema in Melbourne. Now, if you're like me and not exactly an expert on the technicalities of how these IMAX films are made and played, then this next interview is for you, because it's with Dan Drobic, who's a projectionist and IMAX Melbourne's technical manager. So Sally Sara got him on the program bright and early, and she began by asking him,
Dan, have you had any sleep with these midnight screenings?
Thankfully, I wasn't running the session last night, but I'll be heading in shortly to start the day of sessions today.
So what makes this film, the way in which it's shot, what makes that so remarkable?
So this is the first time that a director has used IMAX cameras for the entirety of a film. Christopher Nolan's obviously always championed this format, and he's sort of been inspired by the documentary filmmakers that traditionally IMAX, you know, sort of used to use as most of their, to show most of their films. But he's always put IMAX format in his films, and this is the first time he's entirely used it for a film from start to finish, so in that format.
So just how big and cumbersome is the film print itself?
Yeah, so it's enormous. It's the largest film stock, you know, on the planet, which means it, you know, gets the best resolution, the best picture you can possibly create. But the film itself that we get sent it's over 17 kilometres long. It's almost a quarter of a ton. So it's very cumbersome and very big.
What are the arrangements for sending actual prints of this film around the world? I mean, there's lots of legalities with non-disclosure agreements and so on, but how is it actually transported given how big it is and how valuable the intellectual property is before it's released?
Yeah, so it gets sent in enormous road cases, so these large metal cases. This time it was sent in three parts, so almost sort of broken up into, it's almost 3 hours long, so it's basically an hour in each part, which has been very handy for us because we have to splice the film together and actually build it onto the huge platter that plays the film. In the past, sort of films like Oppenheimer, depending when IMAX have sort of produced and made these the actual film stock itself and send it out, depends how many parts it comes in. Oppenheimer came in over 70, so it means there's a lot more splicing and putting a lot more smaller sections together. But this was just three parts, so very thankful for that this time.
Is it exciting when a quarter of a ton of movie turns up?
Oh, it's incredible, and it's sort of what we at IMAX Melbourne sort of sit here and strive for every day. We're very excited when we get to play film. Obviously, Nolan is someone who sort of pushes that format forward, but he's done such a good job of that and championed it for so long that more and more of these directors are looking at this format. And so there's been more and more of these films sort of having this resurgence and coming back and wanting to play on this style of film.
Was there much technology that was specially needed to be able to shoot this all in this format?
So the limiting factor previously was the sound of the cameras. Like it's the same in the projection room here when we play it. It's such a big film stock, and it's going at such speed that's incredibly, incredibly loud. And they have that same problem when they shoot the films themselves. So sort of in conjunction with IMAX, Nolan developed this a blimp method. So it's almost a large enclosure around the camera that captures all the sound. And it means they could do dialogue scenes where previously they would have to dub them if you were doing anything close. It's obviously such a large device that it needed mirrors for the actors to even be able to sort of maintain eye lines. But it's the first sort of workaround that they've managed that allows them to shoot a film entirely in this format, which is really exciting.
That's Dan Drobic, projectionist and IMAX Melbourne's technical manager, with some pretty crazy insight into the ways that the Odyssey film has been made and played for viewers in this IMAX setting. And that's all for today's episode of The Breakfast Wrap. All interviews were done by Sally Sara and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. I'm Brooke Young, filling in for Luke Sidham-Dundon, who will be back in the chair tomorrow.